Sounds good. Well, welcome to the third installment in our three-part series of workshops for business owners. And today we're focusing on the topic of, as you see on the screen, transitioning from business ownership to the next stage. This whole series has been for anybody wanting to monetize their business and either sell or create liquidity. And have been led by Gregory Kosky, who's on right now. He's the president of IBA, which is a firm, a business transaction firm that's completed over 4,000 business transactions. And myself, Aaron Scannell, I'm the CEO of Heritage Wealth Advisors. We were the number two ranked wealth management firm in Washington, according to Forbes, this past year. So that was some good recognition to get. But how are you doing this morning, Gregory?
I'm doing wonderful. Like you, I welcome the opportunity to share knowledge and be a resource.
Yeah, I look forward to this. We in April, we did part one and covered what's my business worth and how do I maximize its value. And Gregory at that point shared some of the ways that their team at IBA helps sellers increase their value. So intentionally creating a marketplace for their business, increasing the pool of potential buyers, and in other ways to maximize the value. And if you didn't make that one, let us know. We can get you the recording. So we do these live versions, and not as many people can make these, but we get a lot of requests for the audio, so we're recording this. And we've recorded the other two. So again, if you didn't catch either of the first two, just let us know. We can get you the recording. And part two was in May, and that one covered strategies for keeping the taxes as low as possible. And we just see a huge variance in what sellers pay in taxes, sometimes in the same industry. So we shared specific and tangible techniques that are used by legal and tax teams to reduce what certain sellers pay. So we went into things like Section 1202, which has the potential for $10 million of exemption from tax on a business sale, or Code 453A, which allows some business owners to defer their taxes for 30 years, even though they get all the proceeds up front. We went through opportunity zones and avoiding capital gains taxes through those, or ESOPs and dynasty trusts and capital gains bypass trusts. We got pretty geeky in that one. But those strategies have resulted in some of our clients saving hundreds of thousands, or in some cases, millions of dollars in tax. So that's another one. If you didn't catch it, we can get you the recording. But today, transitioning from business ownership to the next stage, we're gonna get into the thing that a lot of business owners don't spend time thinking about until they exit, which is what's next. And this one's important because a lot of business owners have regrets about their exit. And so we'll go through some of the main sources of those regrets, how to avoid them, and then what actual business owners have said they do differently in order to avoid having those regrets that they had. And then we'll also talk about how to turn the proceeds into passive income streams. So you sell a business and got to have income. And so turning those proceeds into passive income streams that are sustainable and reliable despite recessions. So we have recessions fairly regularly in this country. But the income streams got to be able to pay even during recessions, and that grow and outpace inflation over time. So some good content for today, and I've been looking forward to this. But in the first sessions, so again, focused on driving a good value for your business sale, maximizing the value that you can get the sale price, and that's certainly a priority. But thinking about what next is really important because the data is showing that even the most affluent and successful founders, they struggle with a similar problem, which is the regret of how they handled leaving the company. So a question we talk with our business owner clients about is just personally, like how ready are you for what should be the happiest day of your life? And one of the best ways to avoid regret is to look what has caused other people regret. And there's more than four, but four major drivers of an exit without regret. One is having a future vision. So what do you plan to go do after you leave the business? Two is personal detachment. So have you built a fulfilling life outside of your company? That's an area we find either people struggle with, or when we mention that potential struggle, they think we're crazy. Like, I'm done working and you think I won't good to look at to fill those buckets with things outside of the business. So it's, maybe it's starting another business, or it's getting into real estate, or being involved in boards or nonprofits, or spending time with family, traveling the world, or even just unplugging and recharging. And the third one I'll mention is, in terms of a driver of an exit without regret, is about structuring flexibility for the terms of the sale. And then the fourth one is team involvement, so making sure employees are treated really well upon the exit. So Gregory, I know you deal with this stuff all the time, and that's part of your process. You put so many hours into helping business owners intentionally plan and get into a place where when they exit, they're really, really feeling positive about it.
Certainly. So let's talk a minute about the future vision element here. The one of the biggest elements of a sale is the why. Why are you selling? And it'll frequently be the first question asked to you by a buyer. If a buyer believes you're selling with insider knowledge about something difficult on the horizon for the business model, you're not going to achieve your goals in terms of price and value in a sale. So you do need to really think through the why, because it is a discussion point that I as a broker would have with you, but every buyer who looks at it would have with you. And we generally find three whys that are acceptable in the marketplace that do not work detrimentally to value. So the first one is retirement. And at IBA, 70% of our clients are retirement sales. It's pretty straightforward. Father time doesn't stop for anyone. No one questions that.
Yeah, so that doesn't spook the buyer.
No, not at all. The second one, which is a little bit grayer, is we get a lot of entrepreneurs who like creation more than management. So everything can be going wonderfully for a company, and they recognize they are not the best executive to run that company, or it's changing in a dynamic. It was enjoyable when there were eight people of common goals working together, but now you need an HR department, and you're dealing with issues that you don't want, or you gotta lease more space. And so there are exit ramps for entrepreneurs where they recognize, I'm gonna turn this asset into cash and hand off the keys to someone who could take this child to college and beyond. I have a company right now in the electrical industry that is doing wonderfully, but the electrician owner is not a CEO personality. He's an electrician. And the company has grown where from his home to doing $4 million a year in revenue. And he has said, I want an exit ramp. And so we're helping to put it into another party's hands. And honestly, creation is the hardest part with the business model. It's much easier to take it from $4 million to $8 million than $0 to $8 million. And then the next one is the sad one, and Aaron, you and I have dealt with this, where it's a partnership breakup, it's a divorce, it's health issues, it's death. And we have sold companies for estates because the founder and owner died and their spouse, that it wasn't their business and they need to transition it into different executive management. So that one can also be okay for sale. So the why is a really important element in this. And you need to talk to your advisors. You need to do some soul searching and come up with that, because if you don't have the why, the sale becomes more difficult. If you don't want to start a negotiation, you don't want to finish. I mean, mean, you need to be going to the table in good faith. So probably spend a little more time there than intended. The next one I'm going to touch on just briefly is what's your business worth? And market dynamics play a role in that. Right now, the market is very robust. We're coming out of a pandemic. There's a lot of money on the sidelines. People want to buy businesses. They want to re-engage in the economy. The economy looks like it's taking off and going well. A great time to own a business is in an inflationary period because that asset adjusts with the market. And so people are positioning if they believe inflation is coming, because you can move with the market profitably as an owner in an inflationary period where salaries may not be as reactive to market conditions. So those sort of things play into what your business is worth and create good opportunities. And I would say on the personal detachment piece, before we proceed on, you want to sell a business where you're working on a business. You're not working in the business. An owner shouldn't be the hub and be all of a company. That actually hurts your value. So middle management infrastructure adds value to a company in a sale. Easy analogy is you go to a gas station, no one cares who owns it. We go in, we fill up, we never even engage with an employee most time. That type of business where the owner is not critical to day-to-day operations sells at a higher multiple and is more attractive in the market versus using a professional practice. If Perry Mason is selling his law practice, if Perry isn't there to solve the problems of the world for their client, then there's limited value because the customers will not keep coming through the door. So those are all elements that play in the marketability of a business and achieving the best outcome.
Yeah, that's really well said. I didn't know we'd get a Perry Mason reference, so that was good. And then the fifth driver of an exit without regret, it's not on this slide, but it just has to do with proactive planning. So, I don't know, it's like selling a business could be done without a proactive plan, but a house could be done too without a blueprint, and avoiding the blueprint would save some upfront money and time and planning, but would result in big time inefficiencies and probably cost overruns and missed opportunities down the road. So getting a good team of advisors in place is critical in designing the exit that you want, one where you would not just avoid regret, but where you feel absolutely energized, where you're excited. Because look at the number on the screen. 5% of owners are actually happy with their net proceeds post-sale. And what do you say, Gregory? You're driving higher valuations than people thought they even had the ability to get.
Yeah, no, I would comment on that. I mean, the market's robust. I would say that 5% number is troubling. It's not the IBA number. I mean, if you look at us online on Google reviews or on our website, we have a lot of happy customers. So we don't get paid with our business model unless our client is happy. So customer satisfaction for us, like for you, Aaron, is driving our force.
That sets you guys apart in the marketplace. So for anybody looking for help in potentially exiting their business, there's a lot of people you can go to, but what sets IBA apart is as far as how they help people sell their companies is that they're paid 100% on performance. And performance for them involves getting you a good price when you sell. So like a lot of business consultants or brokers, that they charge retainers, those other ones do. And it's not uncommon that some business brokers are charging multiple thousands of dollars a month with no guarantee of success. And Gregory's company, they don't get paid.
point that you touched on is critical to maximizing value. So, you know, if you're selling a car, do you detail it or wash it before you show it? Do you get your kids' Cheerios out of the back seat? You know, the same thing is with a business. You want to make the best impression on the market and realize that business is going to be scrutinized by a buyer, their CPA, CFO, by their attorney, by a bank or investors. So you want to have your ducks in a row, so no matter where they are walking around your business, that people like what they're seeing. And you leave dollars on the table if you don't make a good impression. You know, something simple like your website. If your website was made in 2007 and you've never updated, it's a static website, well, people look at that and they may say, well, that's an opportunity. They're not effectively marketing this business in the present century. But it also hurts your value in that there'll be an opportunity, but they're not going to pay for the opportunity. They're going to pay for what's there. And you just want to excel under scrutiny.
Yeah, for sure. And so as we think about the blueprint for selling a business, you know, the term that's used in our industry is succession planning. So why is succession planning important? And it's essentially, it's just the strategy for passing on leadership roles, often the ownership of a company to an employee or group of employees or an outsider. And it ensures that the business continues to run smoothly after a company's most important people move on to other opportunities, or whether they retire or they pass away. And we'll talk about how to create a good succession plan. So whether it's internal, already in your business, or an external buyer, and the components of what they should involve, like having a clear picture and financials of the current state, having a formal valuation, estate planning. So it's like, what happens if you die before you sold it? Contingency planning. What happens if you get sued or become disabled or you lose a key person on the team? And then it also involves the execution of the sale and then wealth management for the proceeds and turning those into passive income streams, all centered in the personal goals. So the business owner and the personal goals are often in need of being synchronized. And so whether it could be to retire and use the proceeds to fund income streams or fund another venture. And we really, at the end of the day, that's one of the items on this screen, is funding mechanisms. So techniques used by business owners to help employees buy the business who otherwise wouldn't have the money to buy the business. So we'll go into like key man and buy sells and then touch on the tax impact of a business sale as well, because as we often talk with clients about it is not what you sell for, it's about what you can keep after taxes. So the you know, you look at succession planning and some of the realities of the current state, like a lot of business owners never plan to retire, and so while they have, a lot of them have thought about succession planning, only 3 in 10 actually have put a plan together, like have put the blueprint together. So Gregory, what's been your experience with small to mid-sized businesses in getting plans in place, particularly before they met you?
Well, it's funny. I mean, you put a lot of thought into starting a business, but, you know, many people don't update even their business plan for running the business, let alone have a chapter on succession planning. But I do recommend, if nothing else, you begin to build your team and communicate. So, for example, if you're married and have a spouse, you know, who does that party go to in a situation where you get hit by a bus and suddenly there is a president and CEO? Who's your business attorney? Who is your CPA for the company? It may be different than the one personally. Who's your wealth advisor? Who is maybe a business broker, a mergers and acquisition intermediary, or even just a website for a firm that you have a place to go? And we have many clients who are thinking about selling. That's fine, and we are happy to have an introductory meeting, and we just go into the Rolodex, whether they sell in 21, 22, or 25, it doesn't matter for us. And that's where our business model on paid on compensation, when the deal's completed, is unique. We just want to be build rapport. That's how Aaron and I have worked in the past, in that you become a known party for when you want to execute. Aaron, do you want me to take this slide?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. So, you know, the benefits of, you know, your succession planning, providing protection against the future is, if your family's going to continue to own the company, you want to protect that income and make sure you, if something should happen, whether you're backing away into a passive role or, you know, again, get hit by the bus, that income stream for the family gets protected, because we have seen multi-generational situations where companies don't sell. It's knowing what the value of your company and how you grow that and maintain that, so you have a plan in place so when you want to exit, you achieve your goals. Aaron, I believe you've many times had the conversation is, you know, what's that next chapter look like? How much money do you need to have the lifestyle? Do you want to go to Antarctica? Do you want to see the world? You know, how much money do you need for your personal bucket list goals in attention to, you know, a comfortable retirement and legacy? So that's where planning the valuation out allows you to plan accordingly. Aaron, do you want to take this one?
Sure. Yeah, so as far as what a good plan would involve, a good succession plan, it's establishing the value for the business, the formal valuation. It'll address the contingency planning that we talked about already. So whether it's losing a key person, loss of key employees, drop in morale, loss of customers. And it's an entity that maximizes for tax inefficiencies and shelters personal assets. So it helps protect against liability, and we'll talk about more of that in a minute. And it can involve insurance to help protect against some of those contingencies, whether it's umbrella insurance, errors and omissions, property insurance, officer's liability insurance, workers' comp, all that stuff. I mean, that stuff adds up, but it can be, those can be pretty effective in helping to protect the value of the business. And then just communication, it requires communication. So the a lot of times we have seen plans set up by a business owner, and then they don't tell anybody on the team about it. And then there's little fractures of misalignment that tend to get then bigger in the organization over time. So we help to facilitate those conversations with business owners and key team members that they want to involve in those decisions. And then when it comes to choosing the successor, obviously there can be several options, not always, but can be several options. Like some people will choose a family member, it could be a spouse or a son or a daughter or another relative, or it can be a key employee is pretty common, or a group of employees that have a vested interest in the business. And then sometimes it's an outsider. Sometimes better valuations can come from going outside of the key members, whether it's family or an internal person. And then it can be competitors, of course, where someone An example would be someone could, say, provide the intellectual capital that the business needs to take the business to the next level. And that's important for a lot of business owners. They don't want to just take the money and run. They want to get paid really well, but they also want the business to have some level of legacy, especially if the person's going to be in the community where is going to live in the community where the business is going to continue doing business. So we hear business owners say a lot, like, I'm going to see our clients at the grocery store, and I got to be able to hold my head high and not walk in shame based on how this successor is running the business. So naming the successor proactively versus waiting for some event to happen to figure all this out, it just provides stability for the business. And then it can help you or your survivors avoid having to sell the business for less than it's worth or having to liquidate it, you know, a fire sale type of thing. You know, there are a lot of stories we have been involved with where there have been planning done up front that has helped to avoid the fire sale aspects. So Gregory, I don't know if you have had experience with that, but that's something that we're working really hard to prevent and avoid.
Certainly. I mean, again, a business is not a highly liquid asset. Traditionally takes us 3 to 12 months to sell a business. So fire sales don't happen or at a discount. So you do want to plan and have a strategy in place. And I would touch on the highlighted item at the bottom. Can they afford it? So it would be an acquisition for this company. Well, if they're not motivated to do an acquisition or don't have the capital to do it, it doesn't matter if they are the best candidate for it in a seller's eyes. The party needs to be motivated to move forward or they're not going to pay a fair market value. If you're chasing them, that's not good. So you need to have proper motivation. And then when you talk about family members, key employees, etc., do they have the ability to take the helm? And also dealing with the human dynamic. If you've got three kids and they're all working in the business, is there going to be conflict created because someone is following a parent to be the president and someone has to be behind? Were they all were vice presidents looking up to mom or dad as the CEO? You've got to think through those dynamics and personalities. And you know, we all remember Jan Brady in the Brady Bunch, Marsha, Marsha, Marsha. Well, a second child or a third child may actually care more about that leadership seat than the one who's been in it the longest, the eldest child. So you've got to think through those things, and the same with key employees. How are they going to react to elevating a person? So the soft parts of the sale, price aside, but for a successful continued operation of the business, which should be important as a legacy to the owner, needs to be thought through and discussed with the right professional advisors.
And there can be some tough questions that get asked and need to get answered in the process of succession planning. And we can send you these if you want them, but it's just like, who's going to run the business on a day-to-day basis? How much would you have to pay them over what you're paying the incumbent? Would they run it as well as you could? Would your clients and suppliers stay? Will the business still have enough credit available to run and be a viable enterprise? Will your family be forced out because they hold a minority ownership position? Will an unqualified spouse or family member become an owner? Or what happens if your partner dies or wants out and you want to remain active in the business? And it's like, can you afford to buy them out on their terms? If not, who else could they sell to? And then the buy-sell agreements, that's where the buy-sell agreements come into play, and we'll talk a little bit about those in just a minute here. And then would it be possible to quickly find someone who's qualified to replace hard to get things in place so your business is protected, the income is protected, as well as the asset of the business itself. And there's a lot of different types of losses that your business or you or your family could experience if a good succession plan wasn't in place and a key employee or an owner becomes disabled or died. And so key person protection where it helps to protect against the loss associated with a executive on the team or just someone that would be really hard to lose. And that can often involve insurance where there is a payout. In case there is a big loss, there's a payout to help bridge the gap between when the person's lost and finding a replacement or business continuation. So that has to do with just having a plan to effectively transfer the business when it's time for you to move on. And then executive benefits are involved too, where is there a desire to provide additional insurance or retirement benefits to the business owners or key employees. All this stuff dovetails together. And then there's estate planning, which is what happens if you were to pass away. And we're kind of running through some of this quickly because I want to make sure we get to the income stream conversation. But we'll talk about some more of the business continuation aspects in particular. One of the most common ways business owners will protect the business from losing a key person, say the owner or a partner, and facilitate the transfer of the business when it's time to move on, it has to do with buy-sell agreements, which are agreements you can put in place ahead of a transition, not wait until the transition, but do it ahead of the transition, whether the transition is planned or unplanned, if it was due to, say, death or disability. But there's a lot of types of buy-sell agreements. Two of the basic types, maybe the more common ones, are cross-purchase agreements and entity purchase agreements. This gets a little geeky, but we won't spend too much time on it, but just wanted to frame that out a little bit. So in a cross-purchase agreement, each remaining co-owner would purchase a prorated share of the withdrawing co-owner's interest in the business. So if the withdrawing co-owner was retiring, it works the same as if they passed away or were disabled. So again, planned or unplanned exit from the business. A cross-purchase agreement means that the remaining owners purchase a prorated share of the retiring owner's interest in the business. And then an entity purchase agreement is where the purchaser is the company rather than the individual co-owners. And there can be a couple strategies that help illustrate how it works. But let's say you had a cross-purchase agreement which was dealing primarily with a business where there's only two or three owners. And in that example, if you assume there's two owners, owner A and owner B, let's assume that the business is profitable and it's running as expected and all the shareholders and employees are alive and well. Owner A and owner B would agree that the survivor would buy the decedent's share of ownership from the decedent's heirs. And then essentially they agree that the heirs would be obligated to sell to the survivor. In funding the agreement, like where does the money come from for these? Because these agreements are only as valuable as the ability to execute on them. And the funding, so where does the money come from to fund these agreements, is critical. And there's a number of ways you can fund a buyout. And this is an important part. So making sure the money is there when it's needed, available at a reasonable cost, and it is reliable. And there's different ways to do this, but you can either transfer the risk or you could self-fund it. So if you transferred it, that would involve, in a lot of cases, buying insurance. If you self-funded it, that'd be shouldering the risk yourself. So it's sort of like car insurance. You can buy insurance, you can transfer the risk, or you can just plan to cover the cost out of savings if you got the savings. And with a business succession plan, you could buy life insurance or disability insurance, and then the insurance company would be expected to deliver the policy proceeds that would fund the deal. That's how the deal gets funded. And then if you didn't want to transfer the risk, you could self-insure. So if your business partner was your succession plan, they were coming up with the funds to buy you out,
they could plan to use their personal funds. So it ends up being somewhat rare where a business partner has enough liquidity to buy the business. They might have a high net worth, but it could be tied up in the business. So it's like having the plan ahead of time of where that money is going to come from, where is the cash going to come from that you can take away when you get out of the business. And then, you know, another one I'll quickly mention is just sometimes the business will establish lines of credit that can be tapped to fund the buyout, or sometimes the business will put a portion of revenue and profits into a reserve. So they'll build what's called in the industry a sinking fund, they call it, to fund the deal. So they're just saving money into a fund that's there to fund the deal. And, you know, those options can involve a burden on the current business cash flow to fund the future result. So it's good to look through that and figure out, okay, what's the revenue? How much can be put in to fund any of these mechanisms that will fund the eventual buyout?
And I would add, you need to definitely think about the spouse. And there's a couple elements there. First, say you were a 50-50 partner and one partner dies and you don't have the insurance. Well, the surviving spouse of the partner wants that continued income stream, but the labor contribution isn't being made to the business anymore. And it can create bitter feelings with the surviving partner who is seeing profits go to the family of his former partner who, you know, is no longer contributing. And then you also look at it from the surviving spouse's situation where they are scared. They have gotten income from this family-owned business for years and years, and they've got retirement issues and concerns and mortgages, kids potentially in college, and nothing changes relationships like stress and money. And so having a blueprint in place for what you do in that if and then scenario saves a lot of problems, because dealing with these issues in the eye of the storm is not enjoyable.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And now, so let's spend a little bit of time at least on liability protection. We're in the most litigious society in the world, and there's a lot of attorneys out there looking for people with assets to make a claim against. I know some of them personally. And so the subject of asset protection or liability protection is one that a lot of our clients want to prioritize, especially those that have a business, because that can bring additional risks to the family. And some of the strategies that business owners will use, I can say that succession planning holds as well. So important to evaluate both the type of entity you have and the location of the entity when thinking about how to protect yourself from lawsuits and liability. And this is an area where a lot of business owners shortchange it. Like, they just choose an entity and go, whether it's an LLC or an S-Corp or C-Corp. And moving fast is often good in business, but in liability protection, it commonly results in more liability than people are otherwise comfortable with. They just aren't, they don't understand the liability that they have. But once we get into this discussion, it's pretty easy to create some better protection. So here's a short list of things to consider when you are doing this plan. First, it's looking at LLCs, so limited liability companies. Those can help to protect your personal assets from business claims. The next thing, though, is how it's not just setting up an LLC, but it's considering the location of that LLC. So that's what can protect yourself even more from, whether it's your personal assets from a business-associated lawsuit, and it's protecting from judicial dissolutions or charging orders you may have heard of, or foreclosure of LLC orders, which is not an uncommon thing, where an LLC is set up to protect someone, but depending on the state that LLC is set up, it's not uncommon for an LLC to be foreclosed upon, so a creditor, a lawsuit can take money away from the person and attack the personal assets. So it is good to think about domiciled, but think about Delaware or Nevada or Wyoming. Those are a few places to at least have in mind, because if your business gets sued or you get sued, whether they go after your personal assets, in some cases, does depend on the state. So we won't get into each state today, but if you just use Delaware as an example, and I'm not saying to go set up your business in Delaware, but just use that as an example. So more than 60% of Fortune, that has created a little bit of a aura of prestige for business entities that are created there. And because of all the corporations that are there, Delaware is usually more legally predictable, because there's enough, you know, corporations have settled a lot of issues regarding mergers or acquisitions or disputes. And there's just a lot of case law that goes back more than 100 years. And that's created a bunch of precedent setting information on what you can and can't do. And an example of one of the financial benefits that Delaware has is it doesn't tax out-of-state income, and initial filing fees and franchise taxes are low. And Delaware also has something called the Chancery Court, which is a court. It's a system dedicated to business matters, so cases don't have to line up behind civil matters, and they're just handled more quickly. And there's a statutory limitation there on the personal liability of the members of an LLC. So that means members are held liable for repayment if an LLC fails and leaves behind debts. And so this is not to say go out and set up your company in Delaware. It's just to say look at the pros and cons of a few of the top states that have the best protections. And I just listed a few. And I'll mention on this same discussion, trust can be another part of the plan, whether it be capital gains bypass trust. And this is a plan to protect yourself and your personal assets from any business claims or lawsuits, and even to help protect from personal lawsuits too. But a capital gains bypass trust can allow for the avoidance of capital gains tax upon the sale of business interests, and also can help put protections in place. Dynasty trusts are similar, but they can not only help with creditor protection, they can have significant estate tax benefits as well. And if you're in Washington, if you have any money above $2.2 million roughly, there's the Washington state death tax. So it starts at a somewhat low level compared to the federal estate tax, which doesn't start until over $11 million at this point, but that's going to drop. And then last one I'll mention are Delaware Spendthrift Trusts, which provide your beneficiaries with really substantial protection from creditors. And then if you lived in California or another state with an income tax, a Delaware trust, like we were talking about earlier, can in a lot of cases be exempt from your home state's income tax. So the income tax can be escaped entirely at the state level. And that got a little nerdy, so sorry for that. But the next thing I want to spend a little more time on is really one of the most important factors when exiting a business, which is turning the proceeds into income. So it's specifically passive income, income that is reliable, that will pay you even during recessions, even during crises like COVID, and that can outpace inflation. And that's a bigger factor moving forward, inflation is, than it's been in the last couple decades. So that's important. Now, the tricky thing is, with creating income streams from your money, is that interest rates are low right now, obviously. Banks are paying close to nothing in interest. So if you've got $1 million 10 years ago, I guess it was 11 years ago now, you could put money into a money market account at a bank, and you'd make $55,000 a year in income, safely. And now on that same million, a bank is going to pay you $800 a year on average. $800 a year versus $55,000 a year in income. So that it's tricky right now because interest rates are low. And the other thing that makes turning your money into income really tricky right now is that some of the most common investments are not in the most attractive place fundamentally, like stocks. Stocks are trading at the highest prices of all time. So here's a chart of the S&P 500 in the stock market, U.S. at least, over the past quarter century. And it shows a pretty consistent pattern, which is you you've got large bull markets where the market goes way up. So the market went up 106% in that first bull market, and then it went down around 50%. And then it went up 101%, and then it went down 57%. A little bit of a pattern. But this time, the market's up over 400%. It was disrupted by COVID. But if you draw a straight line from 2009 to now, the market's up over 450%, over four times more than a normal bull market. And that pattern goes way back, not just a quarter century. So it has a lot of people, including economists, just concerned about when's the next shoe going to drop? And am I protected? This is a concern for business owners when they come into a big lump sum of money. There's some risk to investing in things that are trading at really high prices, right? You don't generally want to buy high, and especially before there's a downturn, and no one knows when the next downturn is going to be. It's just there is more risk right now than there is typically because the market is up so much. But you go to just about any Wall Street firm, and what do they tell you to put your money into? Stocks. They will tell you to put your money into stocks no matter where the market is. And so, my opinion, there's a bias there. There's a bias. It's not an objective set of advice to go put all your money into something when it's trading at a really high price. The last thing I'll mention about it being tricky right now to create income is if we look at the other common investment, not just stocks, but bonds. The bond market is also right now trading at the highest prices of all times. And that is because interest rates have come down. And so as you see on this chart, interest rates have come down for the last 40 years roughly. So we have clients who in the 70s and 80s were, they had a 15% interest rate on their mortgage. We have clients that invested in CDs, one-year CDs that were paying 16%. Interest rates were really high. And now they're really low. And when interest rates come down, bond prices go up. Right now, bond prices are the highest they've ever been. So that creates risk. So it's not as easy as it has been historically to create income. So it is, we will often talk with clients about how it can be smart to take a page or at least look at what some of the smartest and largest investors in the world are doing. And they're doing something very different than what Wall Street tells investors to do. Wall Street tells investors, put all your money in stocks and bonds and we'll ride away in the sunset to the sunset together. But the biggest investors in the world are not doing that. So here is an example of what one of the biggest investors in the world is doing, the Yale Endowment. And here's their pie chart. And what you'll notice is it's a very diverse pie chart of what they invest in, but they right now have the lowest percentage they've ever had in stocks and bonds. They've only got 3% right now in domestic stocks, U.S. stocks, and then 6.5% in bonds. So the lowest percentage they've ever had, and that's simply because they're not predicting the market's going to go down. They don't get into timing the market, but they do reduce their exposure to asset classes when they get really expensive and when the price goes very high. And so people always ask, well, what are they investing in if they're not investing in stocks and bonds as much? First, they are using, so they invest in a lot of other things. One I'll mention would be real assets. So stocks and bonds are paper assets. Real assets are tangible and could include things like timberland or commodities like gold and silver and corn and wheat, livestock, oil, sugar, water, natural resources to ESG investments like environmental social governance investments. And then it'll be metals too, like nickel and copper and aluminum and things used in new technologies, like the rare earth metals that are used in smartphones or hybrid car batteries or magnets and superconductors. So real assets, just having that in mind as an asset class. The only other one I'll mention here because this is, we do a whole workshop on these actually, and we can send you the recording on that if you want to hear more about these. But the other one I'll mention here would be private debt, and that is when you access the bank and you lend money to private companies. So think how much money banks are making right now, because you're giving them your money to sit in a bank account. They're paying you no interest, and then they're loaning it back to you or other people on house and car loans at 4% or 5% or 6% in a lot of cases. They're making a spread, and so they're making record profits right now. And that's what you can do when you loan money to private companies, and that's what private debt is. And these big investors have a lot of money in private debt right now. So typical bonds are paying 2 to 4%, but private bonds, private debt, they're paying between 5 and 8%. And there's risk to them. Like if you lent all your money to say one or two companies, but if you spread the money out, you lent to 50 to 100 companies, the risk is way lower than the stock market. So I just wanted to bring up a couple examples and then share the why of this. Like the reason these big investors are diversifying is because when you add different asset classes, and this makes intuitive sense, it will reduce risk. If you diversify more, it reduces risk. What doesn't make as much intuitive sense to most people, though, is that you can lower risk and at the same time increase return. So we're not taught that in school. We're always taught if you lower risk, you're going to lower your return. But it's not actually the truth. The truth is you can, if you do it right, you can lower risk and increase the return at the same time. And here's an example of that using real estate. So if you look at the left pie chart on this screen, it shows a portfolio of just stocks and bonds. And you can see the return and the risk of that portfolio. 6% return, 9.7% risk. But then if you just added 10% of real estate, which is not the optimal level, but just say you kept it simple and added 10% of real estate, your return goes up a little bit. It's not that much. It goes up to 6.5%. But then the risk goes down at the same time. And the whole idea is that dynamic occurs for every asset class you add. If you add it in the right way, you can incrementally lower the risk and incrementally increase the return. And this is why the endowments and big investors invest that way. So reducing risk is critical, but improving long-term outcomes is also critical, increasing returns and outpacing inflation. And this all has to do with creating passive income streams, if you sell your business, that are sustainable and reliable, even when there are recessions. Just skip the slide, but I'll go to this one because why does this matter? Because people will often say, and even advisors, like professional money managers, like I had a colleague challenge me on that a few weeks ago. They said, well, it doesn't matter how much you lose. It doesn't matter how much risk you take because things always recover. This guy was right. The stock market does always recover, but when we are retired, say we sold our business and we're taking withdrawals from our investments, significant losses are sometimes not recoverable, even when the stock market recovers. There are cases where a portfolio will not recover, and here's an example of that. So it's like this is what we want to avoid. In these two lines you see on the screen, the light blue line is an investor who invested $1 million, is just a round number, in the year 2000, and they took 5% a year from that portfolio. And they invested in the S&P 500, the broad stock market. Well, if they took 5% a year out, even though the S&P 500, it went down and recovered, they would have run out of money within, on this chart, 16 years. They would have run out of money in 16 years. I know people personally that happened to. These are not clients. Clients of ours did quite well during that period. And the dark blue line represents a more broadly diverse portfolio that includes some of those asset classes that the bigger investors are using. And what it shows is it actually didn't average a much higher return. It averaged a higher return, but not much higher. The key, though, there was lower volatility, and so as money was being pulled out, they didn't cannibalize the principal of the portfolio, and it was sustainable. So now these clients, I've got clients that retired in 1998 or 1999 or 2000, they right now have more money than they started with, even though they've pulled out a lot of money over that 20-year period. And sorry, I'm going kind of fast here, but the bottom line with all this is there's income you can get from various investments right now, and they're not that high from traditional. $100 a year in income versus dividend-paying blue chips, not the broad market, the broad stock market, but if you focus on dividend payers, those are paying $36,000 a year in income. Or preferreds. Preferreds is a type of investment that is a hybrid of stocks and bonds, and those are paying $53,000 a year in income. Or convertibles. Convertible debt is paying $27,000 a year in income. Private debt is paying $46,000 a year in income. And I'm sharing the numbers of some of the portfolios we're managing, and you can get higher or lower depending on what you invested in. And then real estate, $36,000. Or some people hate annuities, but I mention them because they're paying more than CDs. Fixed annuities, which have no fees to them, pay $18,000 a year in income. Or a personal pension annuity pays $50,000 a year in income. Or structured products. Those can be structured CDs through a bank, or you can do them through an insurance company. Those can pay up to $70,000 a year in income. And in a well-diversified endowment-style portfolio, a diversified portfolio can pay $41,000 a year in income. That's one of the ones we're managing right now. It's paying $41,000 a year in income on $1 million versus, again, what the banks are paying, which is close to nothing. Anyway, I wanted to bring that up because it's such an important part of taking the next step with a business and exiting a business and creating income streams. And I already went way too long, so I apologize. So I'm going to not go through the tax strategy stuff, but just know that, and if you've been to our other workshops, you've heard of some of these strategies, but it's not just about how much money you get from the proceeds of the business, it's how much you can keep after taxes, and not just how much income you get from those investments, it's how much of that income you can keep after taxes. And there are some very tangible strategies that are leading to totally quantifiable tax savings outcomes for clients, like tax holidays. And we have some checklists on this. So as a follow-up, I'd encourage you to just let us know if you want some of these checklists. These are kind of nice because then you can say, oh yeah, I'm doing this one or I'm not doing this one. Talk to your advisor, talk to us if you want to do a consultation. We're happy to have a conversation with you about, okay, what are you doing? What are you not doing that could be helpful to you? We've got a checklist for reducing ongoing taxes as well as a checklist for reducing taxes on the sale of a business. We also have some quick reference guides that we can send you, and I'll send the list of all this following this so you don't have to take notes on all these things. But as we close this, I just wanted to say thank you for joining this series. Thank you, Gregory, for taking so much time with us. You have an almost unmatched level of expertise and experience of all the people I've met in your industry, and your insights are really helpful to our clients. And you're making a huge impact for your clients. I consider it a privilege to partner with you on education and events like this. And thank you to clients that have attended, and for those that have listened to the audio versions, we've had a number of people tune out in that way. And I'll just say that the audio version can be tricky because we're referring to visuals, obviously, on these and covering a lot of ground. So we'll just check in and see if you want any of these resources or if you want additional clarity on any of the topics. And I'll mention again, a planning session with myself and Gregory could be extremely valuable. You could share your goals in your current situation, like what entity do you have, when do you want to exit, what your tax situation might look like, and then we can share ideas for you around driving your value higher, how to lower your taxes, and then other benefits that could come from just getting proactive on the planning. So we'll check in, look for an opportunity to talk and help you make progress, and thank you. So thanks again, Gregory, for joining. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Aaron, for the opportunity. And for those who want more information, another resource is on IBA's website. We have a video library with information on valuing businesses. And then we have a very robust blog that was developed as a library resource with hundreds of articles on subjects related to selling and buying a business.
That's a terrific resource, so thanks for bringing that up, Gregory. Yeah, I would encourage everybody to check that out. It's an incredible cache of
information and insights, again, from one of the top companies in the country that helps business owners. You know, 4,200 transactions, right, Gregory? You
felt? We're past that number, yeah, we continue to grow.
Well, thanks again, and have a great rest of the day, everybody.
Thank you.